drive us back.
We have to have 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I stick my shirt? I forgot to bring my little
stick. Yeah.
Quiet, it's serene, it's tender, yeah. It's vulnerable, it's listening. Good work was done here. Very good work was done here. So in these, what will usually be afternoon sessions, tonight it becomes an unusual evening session because of the adventures and misadventures of the afternoon. What I will be doing is to try and raise aspects of how some of the stuff we're working at in the morning with the, you know, imaginal technology, imaginal, particularly our work with the exchange, how it specifically speaks to and sheds light on aspects of our current pandemic crisis in both its physical and its collective psychological and spiritual manifestations. And this is the ground I want to tread very, very cautiously and respectfully, because it's like walking a tightrope above a seething cauldron of political opinions that I don't want to fall into, and sharing everybody's take on whatever particular line of knowledge you happen to be party to, also I don't want to be into. There's one kind of dangerous night, which is tomorrow or tomorrow afternoon, which I don't have to do today, so I won't do it. So I want to start a little bit in what I think is, if it's not exactly safe space, it's probably the safest space to begin such a delicate kind of exploration, where what we're going to be doing, I would say, is raising much more questions than answers, mirrors and turning a picture in slightly different directions so that we see slightly different aspects of it. So what I want to do principally tonight is to just pull out a few, what for me are key quotations, pith quotations, from the Llewellyn Vaughan Lee article that just happened to be the lead piece in Parabola this season, which just happened to be on balance. And some of you may have also noticed, just for the fun of it, that my review of the Assize book is also in this issue. Did you find that, Andrew?
Oh, yeah.
That's great advice. Yeah.
Excuse me.
Before we dig into Llewellyn, what I basically want to do is just pull out about five or six pith quotes that really speak to me in this article and comment on them a little bit, and then open the floor for anything you see or don't see, and from there morph out of the article into any kind of reflections or observations on the day, and then a little bit of quiet. So that's my general sense. But to sort of ease into this, I remember 4 years ago now, at least 4 years, yeah, 4 years ago, when I made my serious dive into Teilhard de Chardin, 5 years ago maybe, and was working with the, you know, the human phenomenon And back, that book was basically written in various dribs and drabs, but the more or less finished version of it, the first finished version, was by about 1938 or 39. Hmm. And so he says early on that one of the properties of our universe is that it's a seamless whole. It hangs together by the whole of itself, and you cut into any slice of it, and it affects the whole. And this was really remarkably precocious understanding back at that time. This was way, way, way before we had anything like a Gaia hypothesis. You'll see that, you know, if you read the implications of what I was working through with the theory of the worlds this morning, Gurdjieff is saying the same thing. On a somewhat larger and more what you might call sci-fi scale than Teilhard is working on, but these two visionary prophets are saying something that we still are functionally clueless about in our Western culture. We just don't know how to practically comprehend what it means that the universe is a seamless whole. And we watch, we hear of volcanic eruptions in Iceland and can't understand yet why soot is coming down on airports in London. I mean, we still don't get what it means that this is a whole. And all Gurdjieff did was take the Gaia theory and essentially extend it to the whole megalocosmos. He anticipated the Gaia cosmic theory because, once again, it wasn't written. You know, there was no Gaia hypothesis when these guys were actually working on this. But the sense that so deeply pregnant in Teilhard was the sense that the Earth itself, me, if we want to go back to Gurdjieffian language, is a sentient whole, and that as evolution does its thing, the Earth itself as a whole is becoming more sentient, more conscious. And he's not talking about this just like there's more conscious people out there. It's not a numerical thing. He has one line, I wish I'd brought the book along, that says, ganglions and neurons on the outside increase sentiency and conscience on the inside. And that this deep sense that there is a planetary purposiveness, there is a planetary intelligence, and the understanding that it's not just human beings who are being intelligent, thinking up smart solutions, and then imposing them on an inert and passive planet. But that the whatever this universal seamless whole is, it meets us way more than halfway. That it is meeting us with its own intrinsic intelligence, purpose, balance, and comprehension of the whole. And I think that is the challenge on our plate, which is virtually impossible for the Western mind to wrap itself around. You can maybe get it as a concept for a few minutes, but it goes so against the grain of the way we've been trained to think about things for basically as long as we've been alive in the culture, that it still is. You know, we can't act what we may only glimmer. But this is being said, and it certainly informs Llewellyn von Lee's take. The other thing that I learned from Teilhard, which has been a precious point of orientation, is basically the mantra, deep hope flows over deep time. And that Teilhard was absolutely insistent in his own conviction that that evolution is, as he said quite point blank, a rise in consciousness. And that over the long, long arc of billions of years, what you see is a steady increase in manifest consciousness within this whatever unit we're taking, whether you take it on the planet Earth or a wider place. Evidence, and his measures are basically deeper freedom, deeper sentiency, deeper conscience, deeper purposiveness. That over the long, long arc, this deepening consciousness emerges irreversibly as a, now listen up to this, as an emergent property of the whole. And this is one place where Teilhard is at variance with even what we would call most modern evolutionary science. Because most of us would think that it's only us human beings that are becoming more and more conscious. But Teilhard was specifically saying that although human beings have a particular role to play in, as he calls it, the arrow and axis of evolution.
Which, sorry?
Pardon?
What was the first, what axis?
The arrow and axis of evolution. That he's very, very clear that it's not just human beings living on the planet, but that the whole thing, the geosphere, the biosphere, the noosphere, is growing collectively in the intelligence. And you have to really, sometimes you have to read that between the lines in Teilhard, but it's a key to understanding Teilhard. Because if you just sort of think that the rocks and then the biosphere became sort of stage settings on which human consciousness does its thing, and it's human consciousness is what's going to Christ and nothing else is. If you read it that way, you miss what Teilhard is saying. And when Teilhard pictures Jesus as essentially the master of evolution, and uses a phrase like cosmogenesis has become Christogenesis, he's basically envisioning Christ as the, we'll call it for the moment, the metaphor, but I don't mean that, for, you know, planted at the heart of the earth as the whole earth becomes more sentient, more conscious. So it's not, we're not back to Genesis 1. We're not at all in the realm of God created man and said, have dominion over the earth. You know, so that we are the only privileged species to dominate. So, but that if you could really, really think that our whole planetary structure, all its component pieces, is a single, seamless, intelligent, purposive, which means willful, discriminating, and discerning whole. And you just can't start hacking into it, fiddling with one bit of it, and thinking that you're not going to create waves and waves of chaos in the way. So does this seem like a fair statement of what's really at the heart of Teilhard? The other thing that's very, very useful in Teilhard is this deep hope over deep time, and that in the service of this general rise of consciousness, there can be perturbations and setbacks that take up not just decades, but eons. You know, and he describes a number of them but of course the one that so many of us are familiar with is the era that now most people are, you know, science is increasingly pointing to, that it was an asteroid that impacted the Earth and touched off what led to the extinction of the dinosaurs and the plunging into an ice age. But there have been other perturbations, and he talks about one that was, I think, somewhere around, I forget how many thousand, hundreds of thousand years it was before we emerged from it. But it was a time when the surface of the earth got really, really shifty and uneasy, and tectonic plates were grinding, and the Himalayas went shooting up, and on the one side of that, pre-hominids existed, doing nothing that particularly distinguished them from, you know, other pre-hominids. On the other side of it, in remarkably quick time, we saw evidence that a new species of hominid was building fires and burying their dead. Stunning. And Teilhard's real sense that things can and are wiped out, sometimes for long periods of time, but that on the other side of that, consciousness is not ever lost. The high water mark before one perturbation will be the starting point for when it comes back again. But this is a really destabilizing way for us to think about it, because it's the whole planet, it's the whole intrinsic planetary intelligence that is driving the rise in consciousness. It's not just human beings getting more and more conscious and leaving the world behind. And the seed for it is implanted in the whole and entrusted in the whole, and will lie fallow in the whole when it has to. And the goal of the whole, then, for Teilhard, it was definitely evolution to the omega point, and this is where his bilingual approach with science on one hand and Christian mysticism on the other, that for him the omega point was essentially when, to use the terminology we used this morning, when all that had been implicit in that first Big Bang as World One tumbled into the possibility of forming form in World Three, and then actually started to do it in World Six, when all that had been consummated in Christ in World 12. So that the latent energy of raw creativity had somehow been captured, perfectly ordered as manifest love. Then it could implode. Its term would be over. Consummatum est. But nothing's lost, because, you know, from the next cosmos another high water part starts. Anyway, the encouragement, which is again very, very scary to us, to think that if we're going to really see our human place in things, that we have to stop adopting a cultural perspective, which at best, at very best, would go back, you know, 3,000 years maybe. That what we really have to develop is a biologic and even a geologic perspective. We got to get used to far longer arcs of time to see the real purpose of the whole thing. And we have to see it from within, inside the intrinsic wholeness of the unit, the planetary, the Earth, the Gaia unit, not from our own human betterment. So, this is where we begin to segue into, you know, this is, I've just given you a mystical perspective to begin with, but that many of the leading thoughtful scientists for today that are really beginning to think of these scales are saying that our planet itself has a very deep sort of intrinsic purpose, and for the moment, if you want to forget theological talk and omega talk, let's say, you know, its purpose is to preserve essentially biodiversity, to preserve a whole in which, remember Teilhard and differentiation and the more complexification a structure can bear, the more consciousness it can bring forth. And so a planet understood as an ascension aliveness is going to have its best shot at intricately articulating consciousness if it's shared by many, many species, and that its goal is really to maintain a homeostasis in which the diversity, the richness, the depth, the articulation of the whole is preserved. And I think that's the point on which, you know, scientists and mystics could still stand on common ground. From there, they'll go their separate ways. But that the goals of the whole toward self-preservation, self-regulation, self-maintenance are not going to be the same goals as human beings who start from the idea of a dominaria mentality. The purpose to be here is to maximize ourselves so we go to heaven, or to achieve any number of our political goals, or to preserve culture, or to preserve anything. It's like dandelion spores. You know, if you really have the guts to stand at the edge of the abyss and really look at it from the widest possible lens. But I think it's at that widest possible lens that you also lose fear completely. Because the intelligence which is so deeply steeped in the system, and whether you imagine Christ driving the helm of evolution from within, or whether you just admire the extraordinary intrinsic intelligence of the whole, somehow you know that it, as an alive organism, is measuring, sorting, responding to its own intrinsic imperative to grow, to flourish, and to remain coherent. And we, as human beings, are at best embroidery on that, and at worst, active destructive agents.
And Cynthia, is that logoic intelligence?
Pardon?
Is that like logoic intelligence?
Well, you can call it logoic intelligence as long as you say that it's logoic intelligence that emerges from within, you know, not a puppet up in heaven jerking
right.
strings.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So that brings us, of course, to the map, and that that almost for as long as we have been telling our story culturally, at least in the Western, you know, and Northern European stream, it's been a dominator culture. And in our very Genesis book, it's, you know, we are charged as human beings to essentially be the masters of creation, to tend it, to steward it, but you know, it's basically a privileged position, which has been a stance. And as we've moved through the wonders of technology, we begin to, you know, we have an initial default position as we position ourselves with this disease of thinking of it as an enemy, as a pathogen, as something that's gone wrong in our universe that has to be fixed. And we go right back to, well, how do we fix it? We'll get a vaccine. We'll, you know, science will triumph again. We will conquer this pest, you know. I think many of us in this room had a real watershed in their life when the Salk vaccine was, you know, how many of you can still remember lining up to be vaccinated against polio and and what a powerful thing is. I didn't get to do it. I mean, talk about trauma. My parents were Christian Scientists, and so no, we didn't take medicine. And so everybody else in the fifth grade class goes to get their vaccine, and they're going to be safe. And my brother and I are sitting here cowering in terror because polio only has two children left in the whole school to attack. Talk about traumatized little beasties, that all the others were safe, and we were, you know, that this polio was going to come and smite the only two remaining targets.
Did you never get it?
No.
Okay.
No, never got it, you know. My parents were not into vaccinations. The only way I got vaccinated for anything was because they wouldn't let me in the school otherwise.
Yeah.
But small vaccine, no, we didn't get it. But, I mean, so many of us have got this model. You know, something goes wrong, a virus is a pathogen, something's broken creation, but we can fix it.
Yeah.
We have science, and we'll go right on, and we'll repair it, and we'll right back business as usual. It'll all be done by this time next year. We all got our vaccine, the masks come off, we go back to making money and forgetting how it was before this happened. But it's an endemic attitude, and the wisest heads say it's not going to work, you know, that as long as we've already been on a long, long trajectory of systematically, particularly in our Western affluent culture, anesthetizing ourselves and sterilizing ourselves and isolating ourselves from the biosphere, and particularly from the microbiome, you know, between, you all know, the processed foods, the polluted air, the over-medication, the over-regulation, the very, very shocking symptoms that speak about, you know, that the American gut has like less than 10% nowadays, generally speaking, of the necessary, you know, microbiotics within it. You know, because we've become so frightened and demonized of that. The leaky gut syndrome is endemic. They say that another thing that has happened during those 50 years that we were talking about this morning is that we've grown up from about 12% of the junior population that have allergic, you know, issues to over 50%. So it's already, COVID already entered a situation in which we already had become estranged from our natural environment, and inclined by our own cultural training to look upon it as an enemy, as a mistake, as a something that needs to be corrected. So a lot of the science that interests me and is clearly interesting Llewellyn Vaughn Lee as he puts this article together is the question of, you know, viruses are a law-conformable part of the, you know, of the microbiome, and that within this they play very interesting and crucial roles. And I'm not going to talk much further beyond this way, but some of the science that has been profoundly put out there in that link I shared with you with Zach Bush, but that is clearly also influencing a lot of what Rob Llewellyn Vaughn Lee is saying here and Sardello is saying here, is that, you know, Zach Bush says very clearly that we need to think about viruses, firstly, as genomic information. And that being small and flexible and shape-shifting by nature, they are very, very well adapted to begin to adapt to perturbations within the whole biosphere caused by some sort of thing, you know, something that's causing a different set of conditions. So they're the part that would most adaptively be able to, you know, whatever you've got, toxicity in an environment, global warming, change, heat, an increase of carbon dioxide, conditions that change the nature of the overall whole. These are the part that basically are fluid enough to pick it up, and in adapting to it, also call attention to it. And this is the way that Zach Bush really goes in for the kill in his article. That rather than seeing them as enemies, let's see them as essentially, you know, reports, field reports, from what's actually going on at a larger scale. Again, issued in terms of the overall overweening goal of the biosphere, which is to maintain its livelihood, its homeostasis, and its what you might call its evolutionary function by maximizing biodiversity and the health of the whole organism. So they signal that something's wrong in the very purpose and in the very point of signaling it, create adaptive new ways of mining the changed conditions to their own advantage. So it's an understanding this double and legitimate role rather than immediately seeing them as enemies that had to be again wrestled into submission by white man's medicine. That we're going to be able to get a wider picture that also allows us to see our complicity in the places where the changes have happened, and to widen our portfolio of creative responses beyond just wearing a mask or coming up with a new friggin' vaccine, which of course only ups the ante, because now they all regroup and come back with, okay,
smart.
Here's our response. And, you know, we've watched that whole thing with the whole antibiotic thing go on. Every week we create a new antibiotic, and what do we get? A antibiotic-resistant strain. So we get a stronger antibiotic to get, well, that one under control, and then, you know, and on and on and on it goes, without ever getting to the core point of how do we get with the program. So it's against that backdrop that some of these comments by Llewellyn, who is of course a Sufi teacher in the in Arita Tweedy's lineage, which is is it a Naqshbandi order? Do you know, Andrew? I'm pretty sure. And Arita Tweedy wrote Daughter of Fire, which is just one of a gut buster of a book about a Russian-born British woman who goes to India on a completely different assignment in the early 60s and meets this state-of-the-art Sufi Hindu teacher who just puts her through a baptism by fire but initiates her big time. Llewellyn is one of her first students. He now runs the Golden Sufi Center just north of San Francisco in California, up in Marin County. But he writes beautifully, and he actually knows a lot more than he shares in this article. But the first thing that attracted me was, of course, the first paragraph. The present pandemic, which in a few short months has wreaked havoc across our world, is most likely caused by an imbalance in the natural world. As loss of habitat and biodiversity is not only driving animals to extinction, but directly causing animal viruses to spread to humans. In response, our leaders are using images of conflict. We are at war with COVID-19, we keep hearing. It is an invisible enemy we need to vanquish. But although this virus is disrupting our lives, causing sickness, death, and economic breakdown, it is itself a completely natural phenomenon, a living thing reproducing itself in the way nature intended. Are those images of conflict and conquest appropriate or even helpful? Do they help us to understand and to respond to bring our world back into balance? And so Llewellyn's whole stance here is that we have to see COVID as a natural and law conformable, to use one of Gurdjieff's favorite terms, effect of a world gone out of balance. And if we're going to participate really creatively in it, we have to begin to think about the whole picture of the balance and think about it not in terms of how it suits us, but in terms of how it suits it in its own evolutionary purpose. You know, more than one person has said, you know, we're the COVID in the body of the planet Earth. And that if we are in an age, as some have said, of the sixth extinction, it certainly is being driven by our human habits. And I don't even put greed at the top of the list. You know, it's easy to say greed and consumerism, but I would almost put at the top of the list compulsive curiosity. You know, that you just gotta, if there's something you can rip apart and see how it works, rip it apart and see how it works, you know. And this need to pry and push and, you know, and I, granted, that's a dangerous line of argument, and I'm not adopting it lightly, but there is something in the story of eating of the fruits of good, the knowledge of good and evil, that remains with us even to this day as a warning. But however it is, you know, in exhilaration, we have been polluting our physical environment, the air, the water, the earth with our, you know, industrial agriculture, the air waves with our, you know, with our GPS system sent virtually unregulated into a what was once virgin territory. We have no idea about what the effects are. We don't like to yet understand, and we can't, that the whole thing is a seamless whole. So prying and playing and radically shifting the physical balance of the universe, the electromagnetic balance of it, the chemical balance of it, and then thinking we're going to get away with it, and that we're going to fix it by creating some sort of razzle-dazzle vaccine, and going right back to our habits, is not going to work. It's not only impossible, but it's flatly immoral in terms of a real sensitive understanding of what we're here for, what anything is here for. So, again, I just wanted to pull out a couple of quotes in this. Llewellyn goes on to tell an old story from that he quotes from Carl Jung about the rainmaker, but the next to the last paragraph where the rainmaker is having trouble getting his rain action started for a while, and he says that I come from another country wherein things are in order. Here they are out of order. And they cannot see as they are not as they should be by the ordinance of heaven. This sense, things are out of order and they are not as they should be for the ordinance of heaven. Now, if you take that away from the kind of simplistic understanding of heaven that we talked about this morning, and try and transpose that onto the Gurdjieffian map of the ray of creation. You know, things are not in order in Mixtus Orbis. Maybe not just for the saving of the planet, but for the role it has to do within the great exchange between the cosmoses, which we're going to look about. And that the, you know, the trashing of our own planetary environment may have consequences beyond just even this environment. So we're getting feedback. We're getting pushback. And it's severe. And the planet really does not have too much personal pity about wiping out 10,000 years of human beings, if that's what it's going to take to get the universes back in order again. It's happened before. You know, if you take a look at, you know, some of those earlier ice ages, it's happened before. And if you see that in real time, the whole will preserve itself at the expense of its parts, as if necessary. And if a part has become unruly and out of order, the thing will go on until the real issues are solved. So, yeah, one of the things that makes things so complicated in our present prediction is that we've got so many layers in this. We've got the political layer right at the top. We've got the culture wars just below that. We've got the ecological wars. We've got the sense of the breakdown of institutions that have carried us for 2,500 years in some cases. There's a quote that I have a little bit later where he says that the kind of disruptions we're seeing are totally characteristic of civilizations in their last gasp. You know. So, and we don't know yet at what scale the disorder is and how deep it's cutting. You know. We really don't know whether it's all about who wins the election in November or whether it's about, you know, finding your vaccine, whether we're on a 2-year scale, a 200-year scale. We don't know. But what we do know, I'm going to maintain from a wisdom perspective, we do know in our heart of hearts what's out of order. And we do know what has to be done to begin to mitigate it. And even if we get a vaccine, it will still remain out of order. And we will still need to do what we need to do to mitigate it. And that's where wisdom is so crucially important. And particularly this imaginal wisdom, which envisions things not even just from a planetary perspective, but from the health and the dynamic equilibrium of a huge system of such mystical as well as organic splendor at antiquity that we can't even begin to imagine the scale. It boggles the mind. So we do know what we have to do. I'm going to maintain that. And we have to do it no matter what happens. And at whatever cost to personal lives. We'll get back to that a little bit later. But before we can even summon any interest in doing anything that has a personal cost on it, We have to have a better sense organically of what must be done and a deeper conscience for why it must be done. So it's some of these things that we're going to try to be elucidating here. A couple more Llewellyn quotes that I like. The earth is dying from the ravages of our culture's materialistic nightmare that pollutes the very air we breathe and the waters we drink and mirrors our... I should have brought my glasses. Mara, where are your glasses, my dear?
There.
Yeah. You know, I'll take them. I'll take them. Oh, do yours work?
Oh, I don't know.
Any sort of bag fine. Yeah. Oh, look, they actually work. The earth is dying from the ravages of our culture's materialistic nightmare that pollutes the air we breathe and the water we drink and starves our soul of its natural connections to the sacred world. And I think that's quite so. And we sense it. The couple more that he speaks of a few pages later. We are living in a time of profound imbalance, extreme social and economic inequality, even as the natural world is being thrown into climate collapse and ecocide. This is what happens when a civilization fails, when we come to the end of an era, and stuck in our present patterns of divisiveness, of contention and conflict, we do not have any real solutions. But there is a different way to be, another country that is not so far away, but in the ground, under our feet, in the movement of the wind and water flowing over stones. But that this is what happens when a civilization fails, when we come to the end of an era. And I just want to hold that comment out because also it's in some sense grim. It's in another sense freeing. Because things do come to the end of the era. The Russian or the Roman Empire came to an end after, you know, however 200 years of Pax Romana. Civilizations wind down. We don't know what they're, you know, if you know the law of seven, you can probably mathematically predict it. I'm seeing institutions dying and assumptions about culture that have really been around with us for, in some cases, 2,500 years since the first axial era. Now, the concept of democracy may be being one of them. And before you get into a knee-jerk reaction of, oh my God, this is terrible, we've got to stop it, because that kind of reaction immediately launches you into fear, into horror, into regret. Sometimes there's a curiosity. Okay, so if we're at an end, I mean, it seems fairly clear to everybody that we're in at an end of some sort of term, but what's the length of the term? And what's going out with it? And if we can approach that, not with a panic kind of compulsory protectionism, but a kind of curiosity that when the old structure crumbles, something is already pushing up through the soil, both literally and metaphorically, and a curiosity that's more a kind of quiet listening. So again, this is views from the big picture. The final thing I had here is he's quoting Richard Powers in a recent interview in Emergence magazine. We have to escape the life of commodity and replace it with a life of community. We have to give up the notion that human destiny is to manage and control and to dominate, and to replace it with the idea that human destiny depends, as all other destinies do, on making ourselves better at adapting to the environment. Novel thought. Because the environment is 99% living things. Okay, so I don't think I'm going to read anymore, so. Thank you. So, it's a slightly different frame, obviously, that we don't take this pandemic out of isolation and see it as just a new enemy to be swatted, but we see it as some way legitimately arising out of a set of conditions that have become gradually so toxic that nothing's thriving in them. Not the earth, not the soil, not the human soul. You know? And that the opportunity exists to address these much deeper. And of course, the place where we're going to work when we come back tomorrow and start looking at an imaginal exchange is that this is not true just strictly of our planet, but is true of our planet in relationship to bits and pieces that are dependent on it in other worlds on either side. So it's the same picture, but with even bigger stakes. And a couple of pieces of the puzzle that aren't really clear when you're just dealing with the Earth become a lot more clear when you deal with the Earth vis-a-vis the imaginal realm. We'll get more into that later this week. So it's a new frame, but a new frame for many. But I find that it's a frame that is both useful and in some sense comforting and healing to work with it. Because it also says that we can lean back into and trust the natural power of the cosmos to cleanse itself, heal itself, and rebalance itself. If we can learn to be part of the, if we can get with the program, basically. I was going to say be part of the solution and not part of the problem, but we already think we're part of the solution, which is exactly the problem. But from here, I'd like to take it a little bit further than Llewellyn goes with it. Because Llewellyn takes it then into what I call, in all due respect, and I love this guy, salt soap. And it's a kind of real, kind of, in a way, entitled salt soap, that what we all got to do is go to beautiful natural places like this and rent beautiful homes by the sea and put our, you know, breathe deeply and look at the ocean and, you know, put our little tootsies in the ground and spend our days with our beautiful garden and quietly come back into contact with the feminine of our soul and the feminine, you know, on and on it goes. It's a pretty picture. But it's very private and it's very entitled. You know, yeah, go find a pretty little spot if you can afford it. But what do we do with the massive injustices economically in the distribution of this disease? What do we do with what do we do with collective obligations? So I'm not going to take it, as I try and unpack these ideas, to the idea of how do we privately get ourselves whole and happy and less fearful and less stressed again, so that if we're whole and happy and less fearful and less stressed, we can go out and be a little bit better in the planet. A, because I don't really think it's happening, but B, because there is some collective work that we can actually be doing to heal and re-nourish the broken and unbalanced planetary body. And it's this that I want to look at. Again, these are the practices that have tended to exist certainly in the imaginal stream and the shamanic streams in most cases, that actions, and I won't call them rituals because we have a very watered down understanding of what ritual is nowadays, but sacred sacramental actions that not only sort of get ourselves re-regulated, but actually actively rebalance the planet. We started to, you touched a little bit of this in the web atmosphere when Gurdjieff says, you know, with a group could warm the atmosphere in Paris. There's some specific ways to kick in that we're going to be looking at. But the maps we're going to be really working with and exploring start with the fact that we have to get over looking at this disease as an enemy and begin seeing it at very least as a mirror. And beyond the mirror, and I don't want to go here too far, particularly at this hour, as a potentially advantageous genetic adaptation, that if we can somehow come to terms with it and re-assimilate it in ways that don't kill it off, can in some sense allow us to move more fully, can help heal us in a really deep way. That's probably the most high spin you can put on it. But I don't think it's impossible. As they say, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And it's really, really clear that we human beings have got to get stronger in all sorts of ways, physically, spiritually, emotionally, collectively. So that's all I really wanted to lay out tonight as our starting gamut. Floor is open for any comments, reflections, discussions, or anything that emerged out of the work or insights of the day. Bill?
I've been reading Llewellyn's stuff. I've never met him, and I know you do know him. For many years, and I think he's... I just find him very, very compelling. And as I'm sure you know, some 20 years ago, he felt that there had been a major opportunity open to humankind for a spiritual evolution into a new stage of consciousness, and that human beings blew it, and that the clear evidence of that was actually not COVID, but the climate crisis.
But what?
Climate crisis.
Okay.
Which he was on to along as many people were, even 20, 30 years ago and more. And I'd just like to say that I have obviously have no direct knowledge of the imaginal realm here, but it seems to me that you can look at COVID as a gentle prod to humans,
mm-hmm.
that we're looking at consequences and situations that are horrifying beyond our imagining.
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to do when there are hundreds of millions of refugees? How many are we going to shoot at the border?
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen when two-thirds or half or more of the species on Earth disappear? All of these things are big portions of the Earth become uninhabitable. These are truly, truly horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
What is going on with COVID is, I understand that I want to put it in context. I just want to raise it as a possibility. It's pretty gentle. But it's a warning about what happens when we don't pay attention to our environment. And don't listen. And also where we don't work collectively to see it best. Because no single person anywhere on this planet, or any probably even 1,000 people have a grip on how things are working now.
Mm-hmm.
It requires a new level of collective cooperation that I don't think we've seen in the past before, and that we're being pushed to that.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's also interesting that these diseases seem to come with expansion and travel.
Mm-hmm.
Smallpox, for example, or the plague, but smallpox is a good example because it's a virus. It started out in nowhere near the West, then it moved through different cultures, came to the West in Europe, and it was very, very deadly. I mean, I think something like 3 out of 10 people that contracted it died. Then somewhere along the time, about 200 years ago, somebody figured out that milkmaids didn't get it. And the first vaccine was developed using cowpox, which is a slightly different variant. And as we know now, smallpox has essentially been eradicated. So I don't think it's necessary to say we really want to have COVID with it for the rest of our lives. But I do think it's really valuable to see it as this harbinger of something far worse that's, in a sense, almost benignly been presented to us as an opportunity to change some very significant parts of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Thank you. Speak up if you can, Bree.
Mm-hmm. Late at night, I'm usually in bed by now.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about this line, this continuum of the worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm new to this material, whereas most of you, I think, have been studying it at a deeper level, so forgive me if this is super basic, but it seems like, as you're talking about the seamless whole and holism, the capacity to perceive wholeness and from the whole, that what you were describing in the worlds was a movement from this undifferentiated absolute, this union,
mm-hmm.
into a progression of distancing in which relationship becomes possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so as relationality is born, there's more distance, there's more separation happening from the Godhead. And that it seemed like it was moving toward this space where our mixtus orbis is a place where the separation is just so, it's just far enough where it can still harmonize without collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to say is there's something unique, it seems, about this plane where the differentiation and the separation is just perfectly aligned,
yep.
where love, longing, the ache of creativity becomes possible.
Yes.
But then if it slips just one inch down further, which is, I think, the human hunger, the tendency to allow it to sort of dissipate, because it's almost unbearable to hold that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we're conditioned to hold
mm-hmm.
the beings of love like you teach. Then it moves into the further, like the denser and denser worlds of,
yeah.
I don't want to participate. I'd rather just be told what to do. I prefer the domination model. I don't want to think. I just want to stay in this this illusion of separation.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose my question here is, in a roundabout way, is this arc that kind of has the capacity to turn one way or another in this particular realm, our realm, is it an arc that moves from union into this tense point where we are, where communion is possible? And if we can facilitate the movement into communion, then we're kind of completing the octave versus allowing it to kind of fall in an entropy out of relationship.
Yeah.
Is anything I'm saying making sense?
It makes an awful lot of sense, and it's the beginning of some very deep digging. I would say that the movement from union to communion is not possible in World 48. Because of what you've so brilliantly articulated, that about how there's something so finely and perfectly poised in World 48 that allows differentiation and union, yearning, longing to coexist in almost a perfect tension. It's so perfect. It nearly breaks your heart.
Yeah.
But in the breaking your heart, you know you've tasted the real deal. And it's one of the exquisite features of it. And for us to think that evolution is going to happen on World 48 by moving it more towards communion, which we often understand a little bit too easily as fellowship or inclusivity, ain't going to happen here. This is what Jesus specifically meant when he talked about the kingdom of heaven, which is, I believe, World 48 completely brilliantly infused with the light of World 24 and above. Like Teilhard's famous phrase was that things will end in not in union, but in a paroxysm of harmonized complexity. What a Teilhardian phrase. But that for me, the image I keep coming back to is light streaming through a stained glass window, where all the bits and pieces that make up the picture in the stained glass window are absolutely essential, or you wouldn't have the image, the form, you know, and the light would just be light, and it wouldn't show any secret, it wouldn't show any of its beauty. So it doesn't overwhelm it, but it has to dance through it. And I think something of that order is what Jesus meant by the kingdom of heaven. And I think a lot of the evolutionary metaphors collapse because they collapse two realms into one and try to look for the future. You're not ever going to push the collective level of intelligence of humanity significantly forward. I mean, that's the whole point of Gurdjieff's Beelzebub. You know, in all these seven visits to America, you know, as a whole, despite what evolutionists like to believe and even what Teilhardian theory says, you know, it isn't a quick rise. You know, the civilization on the whole shows no sign of getting more conscious, you know. They're more consciously enlightened pockets, but cruelty, stupidity, rank carnality remain just about where they have been for, you know, since the get-go. So it's not a matter, I think, of the, you know, that we get on the maps of pushing the whole kind of ball and the abacus further and further towards something we collectively attain. It's a matter of allowing and inviting the individual bits to come holographically into relationship with the whole so they can draw the energy from the very diversity and very complexity and seek their reference point from something beyond which cannot be fulfilled here or attained here. But if you lose the sight of it, the whole thing collapses. They're subtle, but they may have a way out of some cul-de-sacs which idealistic thought always winds up in. So, but the beginning of a long conversation to be done at later than 8:30 at night. but brilliant. Yeah, you're tracking great. And these are some of the brilliant questions that implicitly have more leverage in them than we've seen in conversations before. Mm-hmm. Tim.
So I want to sort of ask you a little bit of a two-part question. You mentioned, and you did earlier today also, this intersection between 24 and 48, the radiance.
Radial energy?
Well, the light, the interpenetration of 24 in 48 is sort of a sweet spot, if I can maybe, or is maybe an aspirational hope for harmonization of the interpenetration of the two worlds, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the spiritual technology of facilitating that is what we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So my first question is, am I getting that right? The second part I want to just press you on a little bit is a little bit the undifferentiated, what feels sometimes like an undifferentiation of the crisis of now. It's sort of, sometimes I hear from people, everything's gone to hell.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's worse than it ever was.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's missing some of the nuance necessary to understand what it's going to take to nurture the energies of the heart, the light,
mm-hmm.
which are there,
mm-hmm.
and which at some level the divinity has done in some ways a good job.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing where we've done well as occupants of 48,
mm-hmm.
and where we haven't, seems to me to require a little more differentiation than sometimes I hear.
Mm-hmm.
And like the stuff on COVID, it feel sometimes, yes, to understand the balancing act that is life is good. To be, I mean, it's a horrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
For me, millions of people. So I don't know, sometimes I do want people to be healed. I would like there to be a vaccine, not for necessarily for myself or for the desecration of the planet, but because millions of people will die a horrible death in poverty and squalor and disability. And is there a way to differentiate the harmonization of life forces from the hope of healing? Because it doesn't seem to me that it has to be quite so blunt as to await or to stand passively in the face of threats to life and the gentle, tender energies of light.
Something never gives up on us. Again and again and again. And even Gurdjieff, with all his curmudgeonliness and, you know, writing about how every time it's a, you know, things haven't, the more they go around, the more they come around, you know. Nonetheless, he taught till the end of his days. And when other spiritual teachers during the dark days of World War II were fleeing to places of seclusion and repose, he stayed right behind the enemy lines in Paris and fed people and raised their spirits and, you know, did what he could to keep them in life. And again and again, the planet sends us out of its mercy, or some world sends us prophets and leaders and visionaries and healers who not only help us to reimagine what's possible, but in some miraculous way offer us a dose of a boost of energy that puts us closer to it. So that healing germ, if you want to call it that, is real and is never going to drop out. We're going to see a little bit more tomorrow why this pressure, this planet is so incredibly precious and vital in the great chain of things. So nobody's ever going to give up on us. And help will always be available. And I think we have to know that more strongly than we know it. There's been incredible damage that's been done over the past 50 years by postmodern anomie, post-existentialist angst that, you know, that says that the human being has no meaning, no purpose in a blank, personless, pitiless universe. We got plenty of purpose.
Yeah.
We got plenty of, you know, everything is in the human heart. And so that would be my way of counterbalancing and differentiating, as you say. The other side, I would say, is it is blunt. And that while I I know how the natural compassion in any kind of deep, decent human soul with conscience just writhes at the suffering of another being. And properly so. That writhing is real, and so is the reality that millions die, and die unjustly and inequitably, in conditions that are just not befitting of a human being. And these realities both exist. And I won't even say they exist on different planes, because I think the planes interact. But it's in the weaving of those two truths that becomes another aspect of what Bree was talking about earlier, about these tensions that you can just hardly bear. But in the end, we know that we're going to have to find the real solution to the imbalance deeper than the level of reaching into the science grab bag for the most altruistic of reasons, the most noble of reasons. We're going to have to dig deeper. Otherwise, we're just dodging the bullet this time. And I think there is enough in the human spirit, and we've been brought to our knees deeply enough, that if there was ever a moment for listening, we're in it. And as Bill said earlier, you know, Llewellyn is all on about how there was another opportunity for listening a while back and we missed it. Maybe we won't miss it this time. Maybe there will be a kind of collective repentance or remorse. I think it's going to lie on the other side of some pretty scary craziness. But people are listening already. And we just have to keep doing it. So thank you for your, you know, your really deep representing of that deep ideal of what's possible for human beings. God help us when we forget to bring forward that ideal, when nobody can even tell the story anymore because they're too heartbroken and disillusioned. Just keep holding it up and holding up the hope. So, knowing that it's getting on towards 9, and not wanting to push this any further than, you know, it's been a long day, right? So let's take a moment, as is our usual method. Disease modeler. Tomorrow is your shot, as we have our conversations with Eva Lee. And so funnel them to Buddy. Everybody knows who Buddy is at this point. And we'll get it set up. We'll give you some specific instructions tomorrow about how we're going to do this logistically. But meanwhile, if you're thinking about it, you'd really like to know. It would help you to understand a little bit more where things are vis-a-vis the disease, the information we're receiving, the future of the modeling, the nature of the virus, the nature of the vaccines, anything you might want to know more about, just sort of pop it over and we'll shape the conversation around that. So tonight, since Tim kind of left it with us, we'll do a chant that many of you know, and then let this carry us into silence for about 10 minutes, and then we'll ask you to walk back to your place in relative quiet tonight, observing at least some sort of the outer form of the great silence, taking in the quiet that lives here, when they finally get quiet in this town. Let's see, what happens if we have one less bang of lights? Is that? Above the world sees.
float above the world.
It's actually sure and steadfast.
Hold as a hope that anchors the soul, which is sure and steadfast, that you may float above the world sea. Hold as a hope that anchors the soul, which is sure and steadfast, that you may float above the world's sea.
beautiful day of exploration. We'll see you tomorrow here at 8:30 for morning exercise / meditation and on and about. It won't work quite so hard tomorrow.